Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Mosier, geology professor here at Wheaton College. I also am on the ASA Executive Council, and it'll be my privilege to be the national president next year. So I'm very excited about that opportunity that I'll have. And I would ask for prayer. We'll be having some of our mid-year phone conferences coming up very soon. So look forward for your, or I appreciate your prayers for us as we make decisions. Tonight, it's my privilege to introduce to you John Hilberg, who is a professor of Old Testament Studies at Grand Rapids Theological Seminary, which is associated with Cornerstone University in Grand Rapids. John started out his academic career on the right track as a geology major at the University of Washington, and somewhere, he said, somewhere at field camp or somewhere along the way, he sought a higher calling and ended up doing a master's theological studies at Dallas Theological Seminary and then doctoral work at the University of Cambridge, and was on the faculty at Dallas Theological Seminary for some years before moving to Grand Rapids. This year, he has enjoyed a year of study at the Trinity International University, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, that other seminary here in Chicago area. And it's been a wonderful experience for him and some other senior scholars, including Jack Collins, who was here in November, to pursue a project that involves some aspect of the study of the doctrine of creation. And this year, it's a three-year program. This year's theme is reading Genesis in the Age of Science. And we had an opportunity to hear some of Jack's preliminary thoughts about his project, and tonight we'll learn about John's project, which has been involving for many years the use of ancient background material in Old Testament studies. The talk that he's giving tonight is basically the title of his project. His writing involves scholarly work like cultic prophecy and the Psalms. I almost said Celtic, which would have been not very appropriate, cultic prophecy in the Psalms. And then, maybe on a more accessible to most of us level, Psalms, the book of the Zondervan Illustrative Bible Backgrounds Commentary. So he's reaching both scholars and the rest of us in the church who don't know more about God's Word. So I also wanted to introduce Charlotte. Your spouse is here. Charlotte Hilberg is here as well, so we welcome you. And without any further ado, I'd like you to meet John.
Thank you, Steve, for the kind introduction, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here with you all. I'm appreciative of the Templeton grant that facilitated Trinity Seminary being able to put together this creation project, three-year project. Is this picking up okay?
I think this is here.
Yes.
Hold on, maybe move it up. Is that any better? That's awesome. Okay. To make possible this three-year project, and it's a privilege to be hanging out for a year with a group of people who are working ostensibly on the same general problem that I am, but attacking it from different angles. And as you might imagine, doing my BS in geology, I've basically spent 40 years living with a lot of cognitive dissonance, trying to work out the issues that confront us when we try to think about the book of Genesis, creation texts, reading it as modern readers. And the project that I'm going to sort of introduce to you tonight is in some ways sort of my latest iteration of my thinking in all of this, trying to bring to bear some linguistic theory that I think helps shed light on how we read texts and in particular, these ancient creation texts and the issue of accommodation, where God has humbled his communication to adapt to finite human comprehension. So this is a work in progress. I haven't figured everything out here. I bounce ideas off my colleagues. I'm bouncing ideas off of all of you. And so I don't come here trying to present to you that I've sort of solved the problem. I presented to you what I think is a helpful way of thinking about this. There's nothing new in what I'm going to say tonight. What is new is the use of this cognitive linguistic theory to help us understand how communication works. Everyday conversation, as well as the way that we come about reading texts. So the first part of my conversation with you will be introducing this, whatever this thing is called, relevance theory, to help you understand a little better how cognitive linguists think about human communication, whether it's oral or written. And then the second part, I want to apply it to reading some creation texts, or texts that have to do with aspects of the physical creation. So that's the map. There'll be illustrations throughout to help you, I hope, sort of inductively figure this out with me. Now, when I was at a previous institution, which you probably all know the name of now, there was a fond colleague of mine who was a mentor when I was a master's student. And we were leaving chapel one day. Now, one of the things you need to know about the background here, one of the sort of environmental assumptions is, at this institution, chapel gets out right before lunch. So this is sort of this implied background understanding that my friend and colleague and I shared. And as we're walking into the door of the faculty office building, I did this, and I said, "I'm going to keep the doctor away." Now, does anybody wonder what I was effectively trying to communicate to him? I'm going to go eat my apple. Now, grab your English dictionary off the shelf and look up the words, "I'm going to keep the doctor away," and see if you can figure out from the dictionary anything there that has anything to do with eating an apple for lunch. What this illustrates is that when we communicate with each other, we have a lot of assumptions in the background. There's the time of the day and the things that are associated that my friend and I shared knowledge about the time of day. What are the activities that are associated with that time of day? There is a cultural shared assumption about a proverb. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. Now, even that proverb doesn't say anything about eating apples. I mean, if I touch an apple a day, does it keep the doctor away? I mean, there's a lot implied in the communication that we have with each other, even in things like everyday proverbs. We just take these assumptions for granted. There's also the idea that I made rather conspicuous the object of interest that was part of the communicative event. So there's a time of day, there's the object in my hand, there's half of a proverb for which he has to supply the other half, and he, at the speed of light, his brain processes, what I told him is, "I'm going to eat my apple." Now, what is also interesting about this exchange that we had is lurking also in the background of our shared knowledge and experience is the fact that the day before, the faculty of this institution, or at least the Biblical Studies Division, had a conversation about the importance, or lack thereof, of background materials for interpreting and understanding the Bible. And there were some of us who were contextualists. I'll just wear it on my chest here. I'm a contextualist. And so there are linguists who are contextualists. They believe that backgrounds, the assumptions that we have in our minds, plays a strong role in communication and interpretation. And my friend was a lexical minimalist, meaning he's more of the type, you pull the dictionary off the shelf and you look up the words and maybe some contextual cross-references and you're done. And so with that background in mind, and he knew what side of the debate I was on, he gave me rather instantly, without much mental processing, a knowing smile of a, aha, another round again from yesterday. Now, that was all implied in the background. I didn't just say I'm going to eat my apple, but I was even more subtly communicating to him another illustration to kind of, in our friendly, back and forth, just, give him another one to have to think about. And he smiled because he was, he was sort of caught on that one because it was sort of in process and he didn't have any way to, to get out of that one. That process that I just illustrated for you is a way of understanding the nature of communication that is heavily dependent upon contextual backgrounds. So relevance theorists, Sperber and Wilson are the two linguists who were the founders of this model of communication. They say a context, when we talk about cognitive environment, Dr. Walton wasn't the first one to come up with this term. It's one that he uses a lot. Well, it's something that linguists use a lot as well. And so we're interested in context, and in the way they understand it, it's not limited just to information about the immediate physical environment or even the immediately preceding utterances. Rather, it also includes expectations about the future, scientific hypotheses or religious beliefs, anecdotal memories, general cultural assumptions, beliefs about the mental state of the speaker. They all play a role in interpretation. So cognitive linguists have defined this fancy word, cognitive environment, we can just call it context in the broadest sense of the word. They defined it to include really anything that you are sensitive to or capable of accessing. So there's a very broad definition attached to context or cognitive environment. Now there's another concept that the relevance theorists are keen on, and that's this idea of the items that are accessible in that context. Every one of us in this room has not just a dictionary entry for a word, but we all have really individual encyclopedic entries for words and concepts. I can say the word father, and there's a certain biological kind of definition that you can find in the dictionary along with some other definitions as well that we would all recognize. But at the same time, we could go around this room and ask each person to share with us what their associations are in their individual encyclopedic entry regarding father. So we all have very fine-tuned understandings at times about certain words that are maybe even unique to us. And the things that we have that are deeply embedded or made a big impression on us in our experience, they are all accessible at different levels. So relevance theorists come to this notion of accessibility. Now let me illustrate it with two different ways. Let's say you're in an elevator. And in the elevator, you hear a conversation going on. The people are, 18 inches away from you, and you can't help but listen, to hear their conversation, the words that they're saying. Now, at the same time, in every elevator, there is elevator music. We call it elevator music in general, because we know it's a sort of innocuous, unobtrusive background music that we play in doctor's offices and elevators and places like that. So what is immediately accessible to you, to your senses, is the conversation going on, and the background music is just background. But what if the song that comes on the background music was the song that, let's say you're married and you had your dance at the wedding reception, and this is the song that you and your spouse danced to on your wedding night at the reception. Now, that particular song would have a very different level of accessibility in your cognitions, in your encyclopedic entries, than would maybe general background music. Let's take another illustration. We all are, if you've looked at the news, you're aware of the events of the day or perhaps this week. And those events, because they're recent, they tend to have a more accessible position in our minds than, say, the events of last week. But what if one of the events last week was the birth of your child? then that has all of a sudden, even though it's more distant, it has a more accessible position in the queue of things that are in your encyclopedic entries. So it's a bit like we are Wi-Fi devices, or not Wi-Fi, we're like mobile devices that are walking around, and there are Wi-Fi networks everywhere, and when we walk into a room, we latch onto the strongest Wi-Fi signal that you can find. This is what you default to, that which is most present with you, that you are aware of. So that's what cognitive linguists mean when they talk about levels of accessibility. It's talking about within the broader cognitive environment, what is on your radar screen, what's sort of under your nose, and then what takes more distant positions in the queue. The third concept of relevance theory is, what is relevance? That's in the definition of the model. So it's useful to talk about what relevance means. Relevance is, again, very broad. It can be new information. That's something that is relevant. When they do studies of people who are listening, they have expectations about receiving something that is worthwhile. There's cognitive payoff for you to give attention to something. And if you don't see any cognitive payoff, you turn it out and tune it out, and I see the expressions all the time in my students' faces in the classroom. They just glazed over look, or maybe they're they're doing whatever they are on their social networking software, because they just don't see the point in tuning in to what I'm saying. But generally, new information is something that perks our attention as listeners. Sometimes we are looking for support for existing beliefs, but we also are interested in reasons to change our thinking. Now, you can imagine that there's often more interest in support than there is for reason to change, right? Often more interest in support for our thoughts than there is reason to change. Now, one of the things that relevance theory helps us do is to get us thinking more precisely about what links words with the context. So far, there's really nothing too new about what I've been saying. We all probably are familiar with the notion of context, Old Testament, New Testament, backgrounds, how did people live, what did they believe, and how we intuitively sense that that plays a role in our Bible interpretation. And so there's this loose idea that the cognitive environment, the culture, etc., is important to us. But relevance theorists want to push more specific and say, how is it that words link context and meaning together? Well, words are guides to relevant contextual assumptions. I usually tell my students glibly that context is everything in interpretation. And to a degree, that's true. But context isn't everything, or we wouldn't have a Bible in our hands. There's an utterance, there's a statement, there are words that we give to each other, that God has given to us, that are designed to hook or trigger concepts in our environment, to get us thinking about things. So words are crucially important because they are guides to meaning. Now, two people that really know each other can have an experience, and they just kind of give a knowing look to each other, and they both know what each other are thinking. I mean, that happens too. But generally, you need to exchange words to be very specific about guiding your listener into what you mean. Now, there's an agreement that listeners and speakers have. This isn't a rule that anybody's laid down. This is just describing the way that communication works. Usually, when you have a competent speaker and a reasonably expected listener, you have words that are sufficient or adequate to guide the listener to those aspects of the environment that are important to the meaning. When I held up my apple to my friend, that wasn't a word, but it was a gesture, and our facial expressions, our hands, are also ways that we sign meaning and signal meaning. But the apple was a clue, a guide to the context of meaning. And words do that for us. Words help guide our sense of meaning. And we need to get sufficient clues so that the audience understands what we're talking about. Sometimes the clues aren't sufficient. And in our family, we have an agreement that if somebody starts talking and you're kind of wondering what are we talking, you have the permission to say context, meaning that so far what has been said is not sufficient to give me a clue as to what you're talking about. So you just interrupt and say context, please, and then you give some statement that sets up the context, and then okay, now I know what you've said, now I understand it. But we also want our communication to be efficient, economical, not trivial. I have a problem in my communication that I go on and on sometimes about details. I'm a very detailed, oriented kind of person. I'm still a sort of science mathematician that's sort of locked up in an Old Testament scholar's body. And so I'm inclined to detail. And I can very easily just kind of go off onto the detail that's interesting to me, but it may not be pertinent to the main point I'm trying to get across, and the people that are listening to me, you don't care. So again, there's this sort of general rule in our family. My poor wife and daughter, they just have permission to just, do this. Now, what does this normally mean? Now, this in most contexts means time out. But in the cognitive environment of our family, it means T for too much information, Dad. So there's a little signal that we can give that I'm not being efficient, and in fact, I may be trivial in my utterances and the words that I'm giving that aren't really helping the communication process. So you want words that guide, and they've got to be sufficient to guide the listener to meaning, but they also can't be too verbose, or you bore people, and after a while they tune you out, and you are not succeeding in your communication. Now, the previous context I had about, illustration I had about people often are more interested in support for their beliefs than they are about hearing reasons for change. What context would you, in your accessible cognitions, do you think I'm talking about? Yeah, I'd say nobody wants to say it, right? I saw Steve here, he kind of raises his eyebrows. There's sort of this cultural, political, social climate that we are living in, and Frank, let's just be fair, people on both sides of this continuation or iteration of the culture war are more interested in support than they are on hearing anybody's reasons for change. Now, if I wanted to be more specific about that, I might say people these days are more interested in support than they are on reasons to change their beliefs. But what about if I change the context on you, and now you are, if you're students, you can play professor for a minute, put your mind in a context of a thesis or dissertation committee, and you say, grad students are more interested in support, finding support for their thesis, than they are in really attending sometimes to reasons for change. Now, there's some commonality between those two contexts, but there are also some quite different nuances of connotation in the association that we give. And in each case, I supplied a couple of more words to make it more sufficient to orient you to what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the culture wars. I'm talking about, the difficulties in academia to mentor students to be fair-minded about their research, etc. And you imagine a different kind of context that's not maybe so emotionally charged as a different one. So just add a couple words, and all of a sudden, now it is more sufficient to communicate. So there's this tacit agreement between the speaker and the listener to cooperate in communication. It assumes competence on the part of the communicator, None of us are perfect communicators. Some are better than others. So obviously this process fails quite often, but we do our best to be competent. And when we are competent, we follow the rules that generally describe the process of communication. So there's a word, or a phrase actually, that relevance theorists have to describe this. They call it optimal relevance. And what they're trying to capture with that is the notion of sufficiency and adequacy bound together. They use the word optimal. And because of the notion of accessibility, we all walk around every day with our our Wi-Fi devices on in our head, and we're looking for relevant Wi-Fi networks to connect to. So it captures the efficiency, sufficiency side. It also captures the listener end of communication, where we just naturally walk around looking for something that makes sense. As we try to connect the dots in the world of communication that we live in every day. So when a hearer, following the path of least effort, remember those couple slides back, listeners are really looking for expending the least effort to understand what somebody's saying. They will naturally opt for what is under their nose before they look for something that is more obtuse. When a hearer following the path of least effort arrives at an interpretation that satisfies his, it was updated, or her expectations of relevance, in the absence of contrary evidence, important qualifier, this is the most plausible hypothesis about the speaker's meaning. Words guide us to connect the dots in our environment to make sense out of meaning and communication. And when we are left with some dots that don't connect, student raises their hand, hopefully. And you stop the person and you inquire, or you continue to process and to try to think through what is being said until you can connect all the dots in a way that is consistent and makes sense. And if there is something that seems contradictory in the statement, then you say, okay, there's something I'm not getting here, and you continue to process what you know about this contextual idea until you can make a good sense of it. So listeners will continue to process until relevance is satisfied. Remember my illustration of keeping the doctor away? Just holding the apple up and say, making it really, make a big deal out of it because I made it conspicuous, which is an important part of communication. Our words make things conspicuous. Holding this up in front of my colleague and saying, I'm going to keep the doctor away. Well, yeah, so, I'm going to go eat yogurt. It was rather a trivial comment to be made. And so, there's more to this, right, John? And, of course, processing at the speed of light, my friend was able to find another dot in our shared experience that made more sense of the situation. And yet at the speed of light, he stopped processing because he understood my point. So we all, as listeners, we listen, we start immediately connecting the dots. When we think we've got all the dots connected in a coherent manner, generally it's what is accessible to our queue of assumptions, our list of assumptions. We stop processing, we think we got the meaning, until something enters the conversation that leads us to look for other dots to connect. Now, I'm going to move on from relevance theory to how we might apply this now to the question that brings us all here, and how to read creation texts, specifically Genesis, and what contributions does this cognitive theory make to how we can read our Bibles. One of the conclusions of Sperber and Wilson is there's no reason to think that the optimally relevant interpretive expression of a thought is always the most literal one. The speaker is presumed, because of this tacit agreement that speaker and listener have when they cooperate in communication, the speaker is presumed to aim at optimal relevance, not literal truth. Now, mind you, Sperber and Wilson, they don't as far as I know, they don't give a rat's tail about the Bible. They are not biblical hermeneutics people. They're just talking about how does communication work from, you know, what the latest studies in communication theory, what model best explains the way we communicate to each other. That's their interest. They have no dog in the hunt, no stake in whether or not you read the Bible literally or not. Now, I'm sure they probably reflected on this because they're aware of debates, but they're addressing a linguistic community. And they have said what cognitive linguistic studies have demonstrated, whether you sit down at a table and you physically test people with questions and flashcards and things like that, or whether they hook people's brains up to measure the blood flow and what part of the brain is processing information that comes their way. They've analyzed this from multiple angles, and cognitive linguists have consistently come up with the conclusion that we do not process words that we hear in series, that is, literal first, and then if that doesn't make sense, we opt for some kind of figurative interpretation. That's not the way communication works. Now, when I was in seminary, I was taught that you go with the literal interpretation unless it makes no sense, and then you opt for some kind of figurative interpretation. I don't believe that anymore. That's really not the way that we process information. We process information not in series, but we process it in parallel. Meaning that as soon as you are exposed to an environment, including words, your mind, if you want to think of the neurons, it lights up with the whole array of possible meanings that could be there. And at the speed of light, as you begin to process, at the speed of light, based upon the dots that are there and the stimulus you're given by the words, the possibilities shut down until you come to the possibility that makes the most sense in the context. That's called parallel processing. All the options are on the table, and you, at the speed of light, generally go for the one that makes the best sense of all the dots. And in fact, some studies have demonstrated that people who are reading or listening will opt for a metaphor before literal interpretation if a metaphorical meaning is available. Why? Metaphorical words are richer. They convey more information in one package. And so we naturally will gravitate to what has the most information for us. So if there is a set of equally possible options, we will, in normal communication, we will go for the metaphor and not the quote-unquote literal dictionary meaning. Now, does that fly with you? Now, I don't know if any of you at that moment sort of process fly, birds, airplanes. You're aware of the metaphor, and you just, at the speed of light, instinctively made the adjustments in your brain to take that as a figure of speech and process it to make sense of what I'm saying. So that's the results of cognitive linguistic studies. Biblical studies are not on the radar screen of these conversations that they are having. Okay, second application that I think relevance theory helps us in is this business of guiding contextual inference. Now, I illustrated how we make meaning of conversations based on the broad context of our environment. It might have to do with the time of day, our memories, objects in the physical environment, as broadly as the institution we're in, shared memories, all kinds of things that play into the environment, and words will guide contextual inference. Now, primary communication situations, that's one like us talking here today. We are, in a shared culture and time and physical room and all of that. This is a primary communication situation. And we all are intuitively processing what I'm saying without having to go through too many groups. Now, some of the ideas might be strange, and so it takes some extra processing effort on your part to figure out what I'm saying. I'm still some days trying to figure out what I'm saying. But in a primary communication situation, we intuitively make adjustments in terms of processing in parallel the words that come to us. Secondary communication situations are inherently problematic. And we all know this as the cross-cultural divide. So missiologists, business people, they all know that if you're going to a different culture, you've got to make adjustments because it's a secondary communication situation. And as many have pointed out, when you're talking about the ancient Near Eastern or Greco-Roman environment to the environment of us as modern readers today, there's a big gap there. And so it is clearly a secondary communication situation that creates more obstacles for us when we try to read these ancient texts. This isn't new. This is things that, you know, that Dr. Walton and others have been pointing out for a long time. This is not new, but what is new about this is that, you know, the current thinking of cognitive linguistics is from another angle, using different empirically tested means, are reinforcing the same basic message. So we have in front of us in the Bible a secondary communication situation. What we need to think about is what was accessibility like in the ancient Near Eastern contextual assumptions? What was their environment like? What were the things on their radar screen? What were the Wi-Fi signals that they naturally latched onto? You know, in the queue of information that they had, what did they sort of instinctively and naturally attach to? And that may not be what we would instinctively or naturally attach to, because we have different sets of cognitive assumptions and things that are accessible more or less in our cognitive assumptions. Let's see. Yeah, so one other thing I want to say about this then, a priori, in other words, up front, this would lead us to think then about things that ancient Near Eastern people were interested in, especially with respect to creation accounts. And when you study through, Mesopotamian writings, Egyptian writings, you know, what little we have from, you know, the people of Ugarit, Canaanite civilization, Hittites, we find out that they're interested in things like the cult, their worship system and their temples. What is the physical environment around them? What's that got to do with, creation got to do with their worship? And so the Egyptians, for example, in their different creation accounts, they're very interested in demonstrating that it was their city where the original mound of dirt emerged out of the cosmic ocean. And the creator God first stood on the mound of dirt in their city. And so their temple's built on that mound of dirt. They're interested in creation as it's relevant to their worship. The ancients were very interested in the relationship between the gods. Fancy words, theogony. Where do the gods come from? And how are the gods related to each other? How are we as humans related to the gods? That was really important to them. They were interested in issues of magic. If I want to manipulate my environment to protect or to accomplish certain things, I need to know something about the way that physical universe is put together and maybe how it came about, because it helps me understand my magical practices better. So they were interested in cycles of life and death things that really may not enter our minds as a first matter of importance. So as we do apply this to guiding contextual inferences, drawing conclusions out of the context for meaning, We can look at a number of examples now that gets us into our creation text. In the beginning, heavens and the earth. Now, if you're an ancient person, let's say Mesopotamia, there are some words here that are, you know, familiar. There are a couple of Mesopotamian texts that aren't very well known to us, but they were known well to them, that actually use the exact phrase, in the beginning. In fact, one of them uses the Akkadian equivalent to the Hebrew word that opens up the Bible. It's the way you started an account of creation. You say, in the beginning. You want to tell us, you know, you've got your third graders and say, okay, everybody, I want you to write an account of, you know, of origins. And, okay, they all know intuitively, in the beginning. It's the expression that they would use. Now, more often than that, though, they would use the pairing of heavens and earth. That's a coupling of words that are used over and over again in ancient Mesopotamian texts when you begin to launch into an account of where we came from. You talk about the heavens and the earth. These are key words that would guide and signal the kinds of texts and traditions. It doesn't even have to be texts. It can just be traditions and beliefs that people had about origins. In Egypt, they had a different language, but they had a similar expression called the sort of the head of the head, the time of the head time. And it's related conceptually to the word in the beginning that's used in Hebrew as well. They talked about it as the head time. You want to talk about origins, you launch it off with this kind of expression. Day and night is another coupling of words that you see a number of times in ancient Mesopotamian texts. On the day they did this, on the night they did that. It was part of the schema that you used to talk about origins. For the Egyptians, they were very interested in it being one day. And they made a big deal about it being on the day because of their particular religious beliefs that it had to happen in one solar cycle. And that was crucial to them. So they talk about the day. But day and night is another part of the schema of talking about creation in the ancient Near East. Formless and void, darkness, the deep. These are pairings of words, again, that were well-known for people who were at all acquainted with Egyptian traditions. And if you want to think for a minute where Moses was educated and where the Israelites came from and the kind of cultural exchange that was going on at the time of Solomon with Egypt, you know, they traded ideas, they traded brides, they traded property, they traded wisdom literature. And so this is material that was sort of floating in the atmosphere of at least educated people. And they knew that the Egyptians had notions of the waters of the flood, or the primeval deep waters, or the darkness. Those are notions that were part of the beginning of their creation account. Creation accounts in Egypt often started with these basic elements. Now, all this is to point to the fact that very often when you want to communicate, you might start out in any communication situation with a topical sentence. And the topical sentence guides the audience to the contextual realm that you want to bring their minds into, and all of the queuing up of the associations and ideas that they would have in their encyclopedic entries. Evening and morning. This is a more difficult one, in particular because in Genesis 1, you've got day that is qualified with evening and morning. And so it is naturally, I think, naturally that we think of a 24-hour period. And I agree with that. You may know that, you know, there are competing interpretations of Genesis. Some, you know, take it as 24-hour days that are normal days, and it's a sequence of events that give us the chronology of Earth history. Some people go taking day in a more figurative sense as being long periods of time, some kind of a day-age theory. And others, like myself, say, oh, wait a minute, you know, just read this text. It's a day. It's called evening and morning. We're supposed to think of a 24-hour period. But that's not the end of the debate, because some of you may know that this may be a literary device on the whole that's being used to order our thinking about what God did to set up the environment that we are in. It's not trying to tell us anything about the chronology of the earth. So when we talk about the days of Genesis 1, just because it's, you know, it's day and night, 24 hours, it doesn't necessarily mean that settles the debate for us. I think it makes a more difficult time for day-age kind of interpretations, a more difficult time, but it doesn't settle the debate for us. Because, in fact, this business of 7 days, as some of you probably know, sevens, 6 plus 1, or 7, that's a very common schema in the stories and literature of the ancient world, used so frequently that you hear 7, you think of completeness, not necessarily a sequence of events that are chronologically related, but it's just a way at a literary rhetorical level of ordering the way that you're telling the story. So just because of 7 days, even conceived of as 24 hours, does not mean that the question is settled. And in fact, I already alluded to what the ancient Near Eastern people were really interested in, what was on their radar screen, what was in the queue of their cognitive assumptions. It had to do with the cult, you know, their temples and worship, had to do with magic, had to do with the relationship of the gods, had to do with the relationship of humanity to the gods, had to do with the world in which the gods placed us and what we're supposed to do in it. I find no evidence anywhere in the ancient Near East that they were interested in sort of how it happened. What is the order, the chronological sequence of creation? That seems to not be on the radar screen in any ancient Near Eastern creation accounts. So from that assumption, when I come to Genesis 1, and I'm thinking about this notion of contextual inference and words that are hooking the assumptions that they would have had in their environment, the first thing that I'm going to think about has to do with the theological issues and my relationship to the gods or the creator God, or ancient Israel, and the environment in which I live, and how I relate to that. That's what's really on my mind. Not sort of questions of, all right, what's the sequence of events in Earth history that happened? That doesn't seem to be anywhere in anyone's cognitive queue of assumptions. And in fact, there are contextual clues that might lead us away from reading the text in a historically referential manner. And you're probably, most of you, familiar with the problem of, you know, light's created day one, the light objects, the sun that which gives light, is day four. And this is not just a modern speed bump that we have when we read the text. All the way back to the earliest church fathers, We find a tradition throughout the early church, throughout the medieval period, on in through the Reformation, to this very day. It is very natural to hit a speed bump when you get to day four, and you say, how do I harmonize this? Well, a speed bump is a signal that you're going down the wrong track in interpretation. The dots aren't connecting without much effort. Remember, we want to find consistent, relevant meaning with the least effort. Speed bumps create effort. So that's one clue. Another clue is comparing Genesis 1 to Genesis 2. There are other clues there that we have to harmonize the text, even within Genesis 2. We've got to go over speed bumps to try to make a coherent chronological sequence out of it. there's the literary patterning of one days 1 through 3 that are mapped over again by days 4 through 6. So there are in it not just speed bumps, but there are other literary rhetorical devices that signal to us that the author is interested in attracting our attention to things other than the sequence of chronology that references Earth history. So this doesn't prove anything, but it gives us expectations that I think we as readers need to bring to the text. And these are our expectations that contemporary models of communication would guide us to make. So back to the definition of optimal relevance theory, optimal relevance. When the hearer following the path of least effort arrives at an interpretation that satisfies his or her expectations of relevance, in the absence of contrary evidence, this is the most plausible hypothesis about the speaker's meaning. My proposition is that the language of Genesis was optimized for purposes other than telling Earth history. The language of Genesis was optimized for purposes other than telling Earth history. Third application of relevance theory has to do with the issue of accommodation. Now, accommodation is just the fancy word that the early church fathers used, and it was picked up through the Middle Ages, on through the Reformers to the present day. The word that we use to refer to the way God adapted, the way anybody, but in the case of the Bible, God adapted the language as appropriate to the audience. Now, a good communicator is mindful of those assumptions that are accessible to the audience. And you don't try to draw on assumptions that the audience can't know about, because you'll fail in your communication if you do that. So you adapt your communication in order to find words that are appropriate to the audience. Now let me go through a series. I have 8 illustrations. I don't really want to get through all of them. I don't think I will. I'll give you a number of illustrations to get the idea. And maybe in the Q&A, we can go back to illustrations that I've raced over or skipped, and we can talk about them and play with them a little bit more. First is the tomato. If you do grocery shopping, where in the grocery store do you look for tomatoes? Now you just walk right by the apples and the bananas and the grapes, and you walk in among the lettuce and the broccoli, right? I don't know anybody that goes to the produce manager or the general manager of the grocery store and complains to him about the produce manager that she put the tomatoes in the wrong section of the grocery store. In fact, we have here what relevance theorists would do is try to analyze the assumptions that are at play in the communication. Now, tomatoes are a vegetable, right? Wrong. Tomatoes are not a vegetable. Ray, where are you, Ray?
There.
Yeah, Ray helped me on this last fall. I wanted to check it out with him, but yeah. Tomatoes actually are a fruit. What's the same?
They are a fruit. Knowledge is knowing that tomatoes are a fruit. Wisdom is not putting them in a fruit salad.
Right, you hear that? Knowledge is knowing that tomatoes are not a fruit. Wisdom is knowing that you don't put them in a fruit salad. Because there are other categories that might be more relevant, culinary interest, that might dictate the optimal course of communication. So this is, I think, a good illustration. Now, what if you were to be the curator of a botanical museum? Kim Walton, you're kind of a botanist, aren't you? Yeah, you're a botanist. That's your area of biology, is botany, right? So let's pretend that you're a curator. I've never heard of a botanical museum, but let's pretend that you're a curator of it. An arbor, what do you call them? Conservatories that of sorts. You classify the plants. If you put tomatoes in the fruit section, we're going to come after you with some complaints. I'm sorry, in the vegetable section. If you put tomatoes in the vegetable section, we're going to come after you because it's a different context, friends. We have a different communicative intent on what we're trying to do with the statements that we are making. How many of you know who Florence Nightingale is? Probably all heard of her. She made famous, she wasn't the only one that did this, but she was one of the chief instigators of making popular the idea of sort of cleaning up the hospitals and purging the bad smells from them. Now, sometimes she would close the windows at night with the intent of preventing the spread of disease. Now, what you may not know is that Florence Nightingale was working under a sort of an implicit assumption, just if you're curious, relevance theorists have their own scaffolding of fancy words, and they have explicatur, I just call explicit, and they have implicatur, which I just call implicit. So let's just keep it simple, explicit and implicit, okay? Optimal relevance. And by their definitions, just the way they are using the language, explicit refers to things that are connected to a word in the statement, and things that are implicit are things that are just sort of in the background that are assumed that aren't necessarily hooked by one of the words in the statement. So that's the reason for my splitting them up on the chart. It doesn't really matter, though, whether something's explicit that is connected to the words or whether it's implicit in the background. Explicit and implicit are all part of the communication process, right? I'm going to keep the doctor away. I was holding up an apple. I didn't use the word apple. It was implicit with respect to the wording. It was explicit in the communication environment. What matters is something part of the communicative intent, something that the author is trying to point at or signal as necessary for the truth statement they're making, or is it not? That's what we've got to analyze here. So Florence Nightingale was working under the assumption that you scrub things not to kill the germs. She didn't have a germ theory. You scrub things because they smelled better. Why? Because disease comes from bad odors. Just go to the swamp, smell the stench of the organic matter. You don't drink the water, folks, because it stinks. And you know that stinky things make you sick. So there's this whole theory called miasmic theory that was in operation. Now, they would close the windows at night, and they learned that this helped contain malaria infestations. They thought they were keeping out the bad air. In fact, what they were doing was they were keeping the mosquitoes out, whose activity picks up at night. So, let's say now that you are a 21st century doctor, and you get into a time capsule, and you're zapped back to 1850. And you are in a hospital, and you are going to give directions, orders to the hospital staff as to what to do. And there's a malaria infestation, and yeah, you know what they're thinking. And so let's just cut to the chase. Let's keep communication optimal. I don't have time to convince you of germ theory or mosquitoes whose saliva carries bacteria. I don't have time for that. In fact, if I try to explain it to you, you're going to run me out of town as being, a quack. So let's just be optimal about this and say, let's keep out the bad air. The nursing staff closes the windows. The doctor has accommodated the understanding, the assumptions of the 1850s medical assumption community. Animal sacrifice, I'll run through these quickly, and then we'll have Q&A, and we can come back to some of these. Animal sacrifices, slaughter the animal, it's put on the altar that's symbolic of God's table. Well, God's running a bit of a potential problem here of communication, because we might assume that with the word pleasing, that we're to assume that we're bribing God. We might make the assumption that God needs food. Those are sort of natural assumptions. And if you're an ancient Near Eastern person, every culture of the ancient Near East made offerings to feed the gods. That's a very accessible cognitive assumption in the ancient Near East. And in fact, Israel made the mistake of allowing the instruction about sacrifice to hook that false assumption at times. So much so that God even needed to give some instruction telling them otherwise, to correct the dots that they connected in the wrong way. They connected some wrong dots. In this one, the consequences were such, theologically, that he had to sort of fix the problem through the prophets and the psalmists. Death snakes, I didn't know, frankly, until, I don't know, sometime recently, that snakes don't hear. Psalm 58 compares David's enemies to a deaf snake who bites the one who's trying to charm the snake. It's a false assumption that A, charming the magic of the snake charmer really works. That's one problem. The second problem is the assumption that snakes really are deaf. They can't be deaf in the sense of plugging their ears, which is what the verse says, because in fact snakes don't have ears. Now, John Calvin wrestled with this problem. I looked at a lot of commentaries, you guys, and very few commentaries even sort of pick up on the fact that snakes can't hear. Some of them will acknowledge it. Most of them don't deal with the problem at all. I looked at today even. I tried to look for all of the Bible difficulty dictionaries, and nobody even touches this. But John Calvin, bless his heart, wrestled with a lot of stuff, and he thought about this one. Now, John Calvin didn't know that snakes couldn't hear either. What he was wrestling with is whether magic really worked. He said, yeah, maybe Satan does something here, but in fact, I don't think so. I think that David is just borrowing his comparison from popular and prevailing error. It was not, you know, this is a metaphor that David's using. He's not worried about, was it herp, somebody in biology help me, what's it, herp, something?
Herpetology.
Herpetology, yeah. Study of reptiles and stuff. You know, this isn't a lesson on herpetology, folks. This is borrowing common imagery to make another point. I might have as well have said, yeah, the enemies are just like Darth Vader who wouldn't listen to Luke Skywalker's plead for mercy. Doesn't matter whether, you know, Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker exist or not. I'm using a popular, imagined word picture to help me communicate my truth. So it doesn't matter. Snake charming doesn't work. Snakes can't hear. Those are not on the radar screen here. We're looking to hook a colorful word picture to help make the point. We'll skip Realm of the Dead. We'll skip summarizing. I want to finish off with, well, let's go to the toughest one. This is the one, now we can come back to some of the others. This is the one that I'm still thinking about. I think, in my opinion, I've been thinking about this a long time now, in the last academic year. This is the most difficult problem of accommodation that I'm aware of in the Old Testament. Genesis 1-7 says, God divided the waters above from below and put the waters that are above the firmament. Now, that doesn't square with any atmospheric sciences that I'm aware of, and probably none that any of you are aware of, although I know some people think that there might be water at the edge of the expanding universe that we just haven't discovered yet. So there's some people that have posited that, but most would not go there. So this could present a problem for us. Now some, a number of good scholars have a good solution to the problem, that it's not talking about an ocean that's a body of water that's up there. It's just the ancient way of talking about rain. And that's possible, that this is just a word picture for rain. And there's some really people who are smarter than I am who think that's the case, but they haven't convinced me. And they haven't convinced a lot of other of my colleagues who work heavily in ancient Near Eastern contexts. And we still are convinced that people in the ancient Near East conceived of a large body of water that was up there. It's not above the firmament for nothing. It's not in Psalm 148 above the stars for no reason. They had a conception of a body of water that was the reservoir from which rain comes. And in fact, the Mesopotamians thought that Marduk grabbed water out of this reservoir and gathered it in clouds, and then we got rain, kind of a multi-stage process. So I think they really had that conception. And so we need to think about this as a problem of accommodation. And if Genesis is not designed to teach us atmospheric sciences or cosmology as we moderns would conceive of it, but there are other purposes in the communicative intent, then this has a very optimally strategic language about it, because it points to only one other tradition in the entire ancient Near East. And that was the most probably well-known account by the time of ancient Israel, the story of Marduk's creation, when he cut the chaos water monster in half and put half of her body substance up there in the heavens and held it back with her skin. That's the only other tradition in the entire ancient Near East that shares that concept with Genesis. Now, Dr. Walton might disagree with me here, but I think that when you only have two places where there's a very specific kind of content that's being referred to, there's a likely contextual link, either in contextual or at least even in the oral tradition that's there. So I think the author of Genesis is in a subtle way working off of the implications, pointing to this other text as a way of giving a different story, a different way of relating the Creator God to the substance of the universe. So what was optimal language for God in an ancient Near Eastern context may not be optimal language for us, but it was for them. So just quickly in conclusion, points we've made, communication is inferential. Literal interpretation is not the default method in interpreting any communication based on cognitive environment. Opening words of Genesis activated ancient Near Eastern assumptions, not ours. When contextual relevance is met, they stop processing. What were the things that interested the ancient Near Eastern people? Cult. The relationship of the gods, where they came from, their relationship to the gods, magic. Those were the things that were near in the queue of contextual assumptions. And when they saw the language of Genesis that hooked those ideas in the ancient Near Eastern thought world, that's where they would have gone. And when they made sense of what Moses is saying, they would have stopped processing. They didn't care about earth history chronology. They would have stopped processing, I think, because they made sense of it. And now, from the time of early church on, they've lost sight of those ancient Near Eastern assumptions, and so you don't stop processing there. Now you've got, from the Greek Aristotelian tradition, a whole different sense of science in trying to explain the mechanics of the universe. So you continue to process, drawing on those assumptions. Which is why the church, by the time of Luther, they're into very specific concordant interpretations of Genesis to make sense of Genesis 1. So the waters, Luther said, the waters above, or it's the ice layer that lubricates the spheres of the Aristotelian universe to keep the spheres from heating up too much. They knew that friction would cause heat. There must be ice up there to keep it cool. That was Luther's explanation. He was interested in a different kind of science than was Moses. Concordant interpretations, whether it's younger or older varieties, concordant meaning that we try to find some reference in Genesis 1 to the history of the earth in a very physical kind of way. Concordant interpretations are not unnatural. In other words, I can see why somebody would do that. It's not a stupid way of interpreting Genesis 1. I am the last one who will call young earth creationists or Huros day age people, I'm the last one that will call them stupid. These are not unnatural ways of reading the text. But I don't think they're the most natural way of reading the text. Assumptions that are weakly related to the communicative intent are the responsibility of the audience, not the errors on the part of the divine author. So when you look at there are not very many of them in the Bible, but when you look at false assumptions that the language of the Bible seems to, you know, potentially hook into, I've not found one yet that was instrumental or at all contributory to the meaning of the text. What was the proposition that the biblical author or the divine author was trying to say? They're only weakly related, and therefore we or the ancients take responsibility for bringing those assumptions into reading. Okay. That's all I have to say. Thanks for your patience on this, but I want to open it up for Q&A. How much?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, take 5-10 minutes of questions.
Okay.
So thank you.
Yes.
So God used the language of
Genesis.
If you use the language of Genesis to accommodate the people at that time that he was speaking to, then that sort of implies that he was not trying to accommodate it to the language for us today. Is that right?
Mostly right. Thank you for that question, because it's a very important qualifier that I need to make in this conversation. The church has not missed the point of Genesis 1. For 2,000 years, we got the point that the language of Genesis, the language that it had, was adequate to guide readers of all time and culture. It was adequate to guide us into interpreting the main points of the text. Now, there are subtle points of the text that you might need to know the cultural background in order to enrich other layers of meaning or other lessons that are also in the text. One that Dr. Walton points out is the connection with temple language. I think that's an important feature of Genesis that I think the church kind of has missed up until recent decades, when people studying the ancient Near East have started to put those things together. So we've missed ideas that we could have enriched the meaning of the text had we known the background. But the basic point of the text, we've got a transcendent, sovereign God who is very good, and he crafted this environment in such a way that is conducive for us in life to flourish. We got it, and we've never missed that point. And you guys, this is no different than any other aspect of interpretation where you're feeding in from archaeology and giving new insight into the text, whether it's lukewarm versus hot and cold water at Laodicea or whatever it is, in the book of Revelation, where archaeology has shed light on the meaning of the text. You got the text. We got the point. You don't want to walk away from Jesus. We got it. But archaeology has helped highlight nuances of the text that we missed. So it's no different than bringing archaeology backgrounds to bear. We're just bringing textual backgrounds to bear. We got the point. Scripture is perspicuous, i.e. it's clear enough in the basics of what it's saying. We got it. Thank you, Lord. We're just now enriching the text with more nuanced meaning. Yes?
Well, to build on that, maybe to provide something, because I deal with this in my classes.
I'm looking at the wrong voice.
I'm not in the language.
Contextual is not, yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, the concern that if we need all this knowledge of the ancient Near East to fully understand the text, then how does it function as scripture for us today? You can reverse that, though, and say that if it has to conform to modern scientific convictions, then it would not be perspicuous.
Perspicuous to them.
To people in the ancient world, we're privileging our age. So I think we have to recognize that we have a historical faith, and we need to appreciate historical change, that God speaks to all people.
Exactly.
So I think if you could flip it over, it kind of takes the fuse out of that bomb in some people's work research.
I'm the first one to say that I think the ancients were very smart people. I mean, they came up with, they knew Pythagorean theorem, long before it was sort of rediscovered. The Babylonians did mathematics with the precision of algebraic precision that was not discovered until the High Middle Ages, rediscovered. They're very smart people. They were capable of understanding a story of the chronological development of Earth history in different words than, than Dr. Mosher would tell us. I think they were capable of understanding that if the words were given to them in an accommodative sort of way. But it's kind of like, yes, okay, well now tell us something that's relevant, Moses. In other words, I think that there could have been this TMI, this trivial information. God could have told the story in a way that would have mapped out in a concordant fashion without using a scientific root, but it was not what was important to them. And so optimal relevance is to tell a different story that helped them with what the questions that they were interested in, the things that they needed to know to live out their faith before Yahweh in an ancient world. Thank you. Good. Yes?
Do we have reasons to believe that the ancients would believe that God did not necessarily create in the way outlined in Genesis? And if so, would that have extended to any other creation story for other cultures?
So let me see if I understand your question right. Are there reasons to think, correct me if I didn't hear you right, are there reasons to think that they weren't interested in, maybe you better ask your question again.
Are there reasons to believe that the ancients did not think God necessarily created in this way?
The other creation stories don't touch upon the same ideas, but no other creation stories tell it packaged in the way that I would say, in a literary way. They don't package it the way that Genesis does. And the content, the imagery is similar, but the content has been changed theologically. The point I'd made earlier, there's just no evidence that they were interested in that. I'm not sure I'm answering your, I'm getting the feeling I'm not answering your question. There's no story to compete with Genesis that you might think of, even imagine it's a chronological sequence. The other stories just don't even try to give sequence in the way that we moderns think about it, which is, I think, why we impose that on Genesis, because we think about it in a way that I don't think that Moses would necessarily have thought about it in that way. Hmm. Now, you're free to disagree, and there are plenty of people who do. And there are, there are clues in the wording of the text that might lead you to think, that I'm wrong.
I was actually wondering about what you just said. Moses may not have, we take it as a literal chronology, but may not have seen it as that necessary chronological order. That's what I'm wondering is, would the ancients have not necessarily seen, oh, this was actually in 7 days? Like, what else might they have perceived?
They were just interested in the relationship that God set up between himself and his creation and the elements of the creation with each other and other human being and where our place is in it. Those are the things they were looking at. And I mean, the other creation accounts are narrative. They're epic narrative. Genesis is not, this is debated, but most of my colleagues would agree that Genesis is not straightforward narrative kind of language. If you read Hebrew, you read Genesis 1, it reads differently than 1 Kings 1. It's elevated prose. And so the other creation accounts have sequence of events in the story, but they just didn't care whether that mapped out in a consistent manner or not, because they were looking for other things. Dr. Walton, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I think that addressed by some of the issues in Sperber and Wilson's definition of optimal relevance, when here following the path of least effort,
yes.
Well, for a reader today, the least effort is going to be thinking like we think, and then arrives at an interpretation that satisfies his expectations. Well, you have to ask, what are the expectations? Are they appropriate expectations? And then in the absence of contrary evidence, well, lots of readers today don't know all the contrary evidence that there is. So in a sense, the relevance, you know, optimal relevance sets up exactly what some of the problems are when we try to read an ancient text that's so far removed from us.
Right.
How would have they thought about these things? Well, that's not the least effort.
Yeah, we want to know sequence,
right,
in a chronological sense. There's
that's
no,
our expectation.
There's no evidence in any other ancient Egyptian creation account that they care about chronological sequence. There's logical sequence that they care about. Which god comes before the other god in the genealogy of the gods? That's very important. You know, that's kind of this logical sequence and sort of chronology, but it's in the realm of the gods. It's outside of space and time. And they're just not thinking in yes.
I'm curious if you know if these theories and this type of thinking is used in biblical translation, or
relevance theory is very slow to be taken up in biblical studies. Dr. Gene Green of this institution is one of the leading scholars using relevance theory to interpret the Bible, and I consider him one of my gurus on relevance theory. I learned a lot from reading things he's written on. He's, to my knowledge, has never applied relevance theory to creation texts. And I know there are some people like Vern Poitras at Westminster, who's very well trained in linguistics, and clear back in the late 80s, there's a very important article he wrote on accommodation in the Summit 2, if those of you who know, the Summit 2 papers on biblical inerrancy, the hermeneutics book, it's like this thick, and Vern Poitras wrote the article there on accommodation, and he's not using language exactly like Sperber and Wilson used, because their theory was just coming out in its formal way when Poitras was writing this article, but he was trained in cognitive linguistics. And so he uses similar categories. He makes, it's useful to make this qualifying comment that he makes back in 85 or 7 or something. He says, as long as the truth proposition of the text does not depend for its truthfulness on a false assumption, then we're okay. I'll say that again. In other words, I'll use a test case. The resurrection. Bultmann would say that the truth of the resurrection that the text is trying to make is predicated upon a myth, a concept that's just an idea that never happened. The problem with that is there's not just one text that says Jesus rose from the dead. There's a whole construct theologically about the nature of bodily resurrection that doesn't work unless Jesus was raised bodily. So the truth proposition, the truth about the bodily resurrection would fail if it were predicated upon an event that didn't historically happen in a physical sort of way. You can't have a physical resurrection. So the test, the litmus test that he gave, and I've communicated with him a little bit about this, and he agrees with me that this is a helpful safety net, because relevance theory, you wouldn't go off, if you had time, I could go off the cliff here with the way accommodation is being used today by some scholars. It's been used that way since the late 1600s. But he would agree that an important safeguard is that the proposition of the text can't be dependent upon a false assumption, a false cognitive assumption, the truth or falsity of it. Does that help, maybe? If it is, we're in trouble. So, anyway.
We better go ahead and cut this off and thank our speaker. And a chance to talk more about this and maybe even personally with Dr. Hilbert. could be had up in the lounge just after Dr. Pendulum.